You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the coldest place on Earth recently had a record-setting heat wave. We'll talk to a Madison College instructor about what's behind the high temperatures in Antarctica and hear about his recent trip there to help collect weather and climate data. Now, a pair of women in Green Bay are hoping to help others who have recently gone through a divorce or other breakup with an online gift registry. Their website sets the goal of bringing dignity to people who are going through this tough time in their lives. Eliza Cousin and Beth Paulson are co-founders of the new company called Divorcist. Eliza, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Rob.
And Beth, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, Beth, can you start by talking about the need you both saw for a resource like a gift registry for someone coming out of a divorce or a breakup?
Yes, for sure. Women, we've always celebrated the big happy times, like marriages and babies. But a lot of the times when you need help, it's when you're going through the not so great times. And when you're going through a divorce, you definitely need, you often need the financial assistance and the physical durable goods that you would get with a breakup with a registry.
Eliza, can you talk about this on a practical level? When I think about it, I guess most couples probably don't have two blenders or what have you.
Right, exactly. When you break up a domestic partnership and a marriage, it means splitting your life in two. So that often means that you are missing 50% of the things that you're used to having in a household. But more than that, I think it's really about reframing this time in our lives and making it okay to ask for help. There's the practicalities of like, yes, I need a new smoothie blender, but also it's just enabling community support, which I think is something so vital to people, but particularly women going through a major breakup.
Beth, you mentioned people, you know, might use a registry for those happy times, getting married, the new kid. How is divorces similar to those kind of registries? How is it different?
Well, it's similar in that it can definitely be a celebration. You can give gifts because you're happy and because you're moving on to a new part of your life. So it symbolizes the beginning of something new, which in many cases is very, very good. So it can be a celebration. It's different in that we have heightened security features for people. It's not as easy. It's impossible to get a user's address because domestic violence is a factor in breakups so much of the time.
Now, Eliza, this is a technology startup, but you're not, in the Bay Area in Silicon Valley. You're in the Green Bay area. Can you talk about challenges starting up this tech startup here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, the other Bay Area. Or I'm trying to make Silicon Lakeshore like a thing. So help it spread, bro. But yeah, I think there is an assumption that companies like ours can only come out of the coasts, and that innovation doesn't happen in the Midwest or in these small to medium cities like Green Bay. So what we're really doing is, you know, pioneering and proving to everyone that two moms can start a business that can be valued at, you know, multi-millions of dollars. I think we are at a bit of a disadvantage as founders being up here because there just isn't that network. You know, we can't go out to a networking dinner in San Francisco and be introduced to 20 people who will invest in us or mentor us. Instead, we might go to 20 networking dinners and meet three people. But then at the other side of things, everyone we do meet is so excited and so willing to support us. There's a real sense of optimism about small business and startups happening in small cities. And Green Bay is no exception. And we're very grateful for all the local support we've received.
And speaking of small business, Beth, did I see on your registry you try, at least when possible, to steer people toward gifts they can get from smaller businesses?
Yep, absolutely. We're looking for partnerships, of course, across the board, big and small. But at this point, we really want to help sustain the smaller businesses, which, as we've experienced, can often be more women-owned or minority-owned, just to kind of level the playing field in our small way.
Eliza, you had a soft launch of Divorcist, I understand, in the late fall, the full-on going live earlier this month. How are things going so far?
We're just thrilled. We're overjoyed by the reception. We're seeing all the signups go up and up every day. And we're just thrilled. You know, we had some doubters either, you know, say that there wouldn't be a market for this or that this was just people clamoring for gifts and being tasteless. But instead, what we're seeing is this overwhelming need for our service straight away. So, you know, we've been live for just 4 weeks and we are hard at work supporting our first customers and helping people build their newly single lives.
Beth, I wonder, you know, suppose somebody out there is listening and has been thinking, I got this great idea for a startup, a business I could do here in Wisconsin, but I don't see myself as an entrepreneur. I'm not like a fancy, wealthy person in the Silicon Valley area. What would you say to them to encourage them to at least explore that notion?
Well, I would say it does certainly help, I would imagine, to be a wealthy person in the Bay Area. But if you're a normal mom from Green Bay, Wisconsin, there actually are resources out there. The Blueprint Green Bay does amazing work with the Chamber of Commerce. It's an emerging field. We feel like we're right kind of at the crest of the wave of this new interest being taken in women co-founders and minority co-founders. So it's becoming a little bit more open to just everyday people.
We'll leave it there. Beth and Eliza, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Eliza Cousin and Beth Paulson are co-founders of the Green Bay-based gift registry website for newly single people. It's called Divorcist. We talked to them about the needs they're trying to address with their business and what it's been like as female-led tech startups not based in Silicon Valley. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary-Kate McCoy with a story about a friendly debate between two beloved Wisconsin desserts.
We recently received an audience question through WPR's Wisconsin Project about two iconic Wisconsin pastries, the cream puff and the kringle. WPR's Tim Peterson was up to the task of getting to the bottom, or at least the delicious sugary middle, of what separates them.
Marissa Wojcik of Madison grew up in the Eau Claire area, regularly consuming kringle at family gatherings. Her experience with cream puff, on the other hand, is limited. Just one puff. And it did not blow her away, which prompted her to ask us,
why do cream puffs get all the attention when the kringle is the official state pastry of Wisconsin?
Well, certainly cream puffs have been a signature dessert of the Wisconsin State Fair since 1924.
Paula Hare is Director of Marketing and Media Relations for Original Cream Puffs. That's the pop-up bakery from the Wisconsin Bakers Association responsible for making and serving cream puffs for that annual 11-day run.
It is certainly the most popular and longest-running food item at the state fair. I mean, picture in your mind, you know, all of the sights and sounds of the fair and the giant Ferris wheel lights, and having your first cream puff is certainly an experience just like going to the fair. Our cream puffs are made from Wisconsin dairy-rich cream and also a very wonderful puff pastry, and biting into them is just like a little piece of heaven.
But some people push back on our very serious kringle versus cream puff premise.
Well, cream puffs are delightful. This is the most friendly debate ever.
Shauna Seaver, author of the cookbook Midwest Made, Big Bold Baking from the Heartland. She also had thoughts on the cream puff.
Is that nostalgic feel of the state fair, and it's something special that you're not going to have all the time. I mean, and it's something that's like towering and beautiful and delightful and a little over the top, and I think definitely has a place.
Now, for the official state pastry, so anointed by the legislature in 2013, here's Seaver again.
Well, Kringle came to Wisconsin in the late 1800s when there was a huge boom of immigrants from all over Europe in particular, and Wisconsin took a lot of them in, and it became the sort of landing place for a lot of very baking-centric countries, lucky for Wisconsin. And the kringle was an invention from Denmark, originally actually started out in a sort of pretzel shape, and you still find them in Denmark baked in that way. And then, like so many other baked goods, sort of evolve as they land in their new home. And like any innovative group of immigrants, they sort of tweaked the kringle a little bit for local tastes, and it's been around ever since.
We wanted to dig a little deeper, get under the crust of what separates these two. Seaver gives us a quick lesson, starting with the cream puff.
In terms of the technique, choux pastry comes together rather quickly, and you can bake it, you know, straight out of the mixer. And then you can dollop your puffs, and then they're baked off. And then when you're talking about kringle, it's actually based on a Danish pastry, which is kind of similar to a French puff pastry, but there's the addition of yeast, which gives it a little more rise and, of course, that delicious flavor. But it's a laminated dough, which essentially means that you're going to incorporate the butter by rolling and folding the dough several times. So it can be a couple day process to make yourself a good kringle, which I think is something that a lot of us take for granted because it's something easy to sort of grab and have, you know, for coffee breaks. But they really are very well-crafted, time-consuming pastry.
And like the cream puff, kringle has a special yet different place in our hearts.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that story about two beloved Wisconsin pastries. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, a Madison College instructor joins the show to tell us about his work building weather stations in Antarctica and to talk about how that data is then used to research climate change. That's up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Antarctica is the coldest continent on Earth, but earlier this month, a record-setting heat wave shook things up. Our next guest is part of a team that makes weather measurements like that possible. He builds weather stations across Antarctica that collect all kinds of data, and then researchers use that data to study things, including climate change. Lee Wellhouse is a physical sciences instructor at Madison College. He's also an instrumentation engineer with UW-Madison's Automatic Weather Station Project. He recently got back from a trip to Antarctica. Lee, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I wanted to ask you about your first day on the job. You walk out to clock in, and you're in Antarctica. What was that first look at this continent like for you?
So it was about a decade ago now. So it's always tough to like look back at how I remember things, but it's interesting. You get off of a plane and you're not landing on a runway. You're landing on an ice runway. So you get off and you're on an ice sheet and you see in every direction, nothing but ice sheet, maybe some mountains off in the distance that are covered in ice. It's very similar, somewhat similar to Wisconsin in winter, but just amped up to 11.
I would probably say Lambeau Field, the frozen tundra, as I stepped off. That's me. But what can you tell us about the work you do on these weather stations in Antarctica?
Oh, absolutely. So we have a network of around 60 weather stations, and we've been running a program for the National Science Foundation for the past 40 years. And a part of that is maintaining the weather stations. Antarctica is a very difficult place to have equipment. Everything breaks. It's cold, it's windy, things fall apart, and you can only be there for a few months out of the year. So every year we have to go to a subset of the sites and fix things because various things will fall off, various things will break, just eventually everything degrades. So, and things get buried by snow. So we're digging up equipment, we're raising it back to the correct heights, and then making sure everything's in good shape, working and transmitting so we're actually getting all the data.
And you recently got back from a trip to Antarctica. You know, our winter, I believe, is Antarctica's summer. Correct me if I'm wrong. Tell us a little bit about
that's perfectly correct.
Yeah, what did you see there? What were things like in this Antarctic summer?
So it was actually a pretty interesting year this year. We mainly stayed in the McMurdo base, which is the main U.S. base. So we didn't get far afield. We didn't go to South Pole this year. We didn't go to West Antarctica, which involves camping, but we did get to go to a number of sites on the Ross Ice Shelf, which is ice shelf that's closest to McMurdo, and got to see a lot of cold, a lot of snow, and I like to think of it as Wisconsin winter, only instead of it being dark most of the time, it's sunny all the time and similar temperatures.
Now, just after you left, people may have seen this in the news, a record heat wave in Antarctica. Can you tell us what's going on there?
So that happened in East Antarctica. So for those listening, Antarctica can be split into East and West Antarctica. East Antarctica is higher. It's a much higher plateau, much colder, and a much larger area than West Antarctica. And they recently got what we call an atmospheric river, basically a really strong storm system moving into the area, bringing a lot of moisture and a lot of energy. And normally these systems just rotate around the continent. This one actually forced its way into East Antarctica and sat there for around a week. And it's dark most of the day at this point, in closer to the coast. It was getting a little bit of sunlight, but not much. And we're in the point of basically 24 hours of darkness. To see massive temperature increases is relatively rare. But it's caused by basically that energy being brought in, cloud cover keeping that energy from being able to escape to space, and just staying nice and warm, which is, again, super rare. And by warm, I mean still 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
But that's 70 degrees warmer than normal, right? That's a big difference.
Oh, yes, it's absolutely. It's a massive, massive difference from what they're normally seeing. And now this week, they're back to their normal temperatures in the like negative 60s, negative 80s temperatures.
We're talking to Madison College instructor Lee Wellhouse about his work with UW-Madison's Automatic Weather Station project, which collects data from Antarctica. All right, Lee, your instruments are there. You've repaired them. The data comes through. What then do we learn from all this weather data?
So we get to learn a lot of interesting things. So first of all, we're learning about the weather systems that are impacting specific locations. And that's super important from a perspective of we want to work there. Other science wants to be done there. It helps us forecast. It helps us understand what we're getting into because you're far away from civilization. So that helps us do our work and other groups do their work safely. It also allows us to understand the climate of Antarctica. It's a unique location. Different things are going on, and we can monitor it and understand it better going forward.
There was more Antarctic news lately, an ice shelf in East Antarctica collapsing. Why is that significant?
So it's East Antarctica has been a very, very stable environment for ice and ice shelves and ice sheets for the entirety of the satellite record. So the past 40 years, that we haven't had an ice sheet collapse. West Antarctica, by comparison, has had a lot more ice sheets collapse, ice shelves have issues, and we're seeing a lot more ice loss in that region. So to see things like this happening in East Antarctica is a bit unexpected and also a bit more like newsworthy and a bit concerning.
Concerning why?
Again, because if we're expecting that area to be more stable, for these ice sheets to be more consistent and not collapse in this way, by seeing them collapse, that tells us that things are changing in this region to some degree. Not as extensively as West Antarctica, but we're still seeing the change in the ice dynamics and in the climate of the East Antarctica.
Yeah, with the urgency of climate change, how big a piece of the puzzle is getting a better understanding of what's going on in Antarctica for what's going to affect us and the rest of the planet?
It's a pretty massive part of the puzzle, especially, like I mentioned, West Antarctica, we're seeing a lot more ice loss and issues with ice sheet collapse. And there have been recent news about the Thwaites Glacier and the possibility of collapse there. These all play a major role in sea level change in the near future. The ice sheets collapsing themselves, I want to be clear, those aren't going to impact sea ice directly. But by getting rid of those ice sheets, you expose the glaciers that are land-based behind them to the water. Basically, they're able to dump their ice into the water more directly, and that does raise sea level, and that is a major problem.
Right, so the ice sheets on the water are kind of like a plug for the ice sheets on the land, and when that land stuff starts to hit the water, that's, if I'm hearing you right, that's when sea levels around the world can go up?
That's exactly correct. That's generally how it works. Basically, like you said, they act as a plug or a dam that's sitting there, and they act as a buffer. And when that buffer's gone, things can speed up and the dynamics can change rapidly.
What for you, Lee, are the most interesting or important questions that we still don't have answers for when it comes to weather and climate in Antarctica?
Well, that's a tough question because they're it's a unique place. Obviously, just Antarctica being a large continent and not having a lot of observations, we just need more observations in more places. It's just we're getting a better understanding of the areas we're able to get to, but just it's a big place. There's a lot of things that can go sort of overlooked or missed because we don't have observations in all the locations, and satellites help us with that, but there's still more to be done there.
Right, a lot of big questions there, Lee, but I gotta ask, in our last few moments, do you ever have moments where you're like, I'm standing on Antarctica? Like, I'm part of this, like, incredibly small percentage of all the humans who ever lived who are on this continent?
Oh, absolutely. That happens every year, and it's a big part. It's a feeling that brings me back every year.
Lee, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Lee Wellhaus. He's an instrumentation engineer with UW-Madison's Automatic Weather Station project in Antarctica and a physical sciences instructor at Madison College. He was with us today to talk about his work in Antarctica and a record heat wave that hit that continent. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, lobbying broke records last year with businesses and interest groups spending big in the nation's capital. Find out what's driving that trend and what kind of influence that money can buy. Plus, get an update on the Russian invasion of Ukraine and efforts by the U.S. and NATO to help Ukraine without provoking a wider conflict. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll hear about recent survey data that shows the spread of the QAnon conspiracy theory and what that means for today's political environment. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, millions of Ukrainians are fleeing the country as refugees. We'll explore the U.S. role in helping deal with the crisis. First, recent survey data from the Public Religion Research Institute shows that the following of the conspiracy theory, QAnon, has increased since former President Donald Trump was in office. The far-right conspiracy gained popularity during Trump's presidency and the 2020 presidential campaign. Our next guest is behind that research and is here to help us understand the reach of QAnon and its impact on American politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this? Do you know someone who believes in QAnon or promotes its theories in person or on social media? Do you think it's a threat or just a fringe thing that we don't need to pay too much attention to? Call in with your comments, your experiences, maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Robert P. Jones is the CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute, author of the book White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. Robert, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Before we get to your new research, can you give us QAnon 101? Where did it come from? What are the basic beliefs?
Yeah, well, it is a, you know, internet-based and social media-based conspiracy theory that has really also been, importantly, promoted on far-right political news channels, including One American News, Newsmax, and Fox. So it has a kind of life on social media, and then it has a kind of little more mainstream view on cable news. So it's a challenge as a researcher to get your head around it. It has several sort of tendrils out there, but we spent some time, doing some research, looking at message boards and looking at trying to get our heads around the core beliefs and basically ended up measuring three core beliefs. Here they come. So the first one, and these are all kind of agree, disagree questions that we had in some national surveys in 2021. The first tenet is the government, media, and financial worlds in the U.S. are controlled by a group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking operation. Now, that's a survey question I never thought I'd write as a researcher. The second one is kind of an apocalyptic aspect, that there's a storm coming soon that will sweep away the elites in power and restore the rightful leaders. And the third one is a propensity for political violence, that because things have gotten so far off track, true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country. And so in the survey, we combined all three of those questions and classified people who believed all three of these tenets as QAnon believers.
There was a thought, I think, out there that after the Trump presidency ended, it was one of the things fueling the QAnon conspiracy theory. Therefore, people believing those things would decline. What did you find, though, in your surveys?
Yeah, well, I mean, any student of religion knows that kind of millennialist or apocalyptic movements always find ways to resurrect themselves, even after their predictions don't come true. But, you know, they were predicting Trump would win the election, that he would be installed no matter what was going on in the Electoral College, et cetera. And, you know, basically what we found is that belief in this ticked up slightly throughout 2021. So in March, it was 14% of the public that believed all three of those statements that I read earlier, and that it actually ticked up to 17% by the fall of 2021. Overall, it's basically 16. If you average all that out, it's 16% of the population of the country. But it's 1 in 4 Republicans and 1 in 4 white evangelical Protestants that believe, again, all three of these statements.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. Your guest answered part of my question, but basically I was wondering about the demographics of QAnon followers, ethnicity, age, economic income, education.
Tom, thanks for the call. Robert, you just mentioned Republicans more likely than others to follow this white evangelical Christians. What else do we know about core QAnon followers?
Right. So we did actually some fair amount of analysis on this. The data set that we have is quite large. It's about 20,000 Americans that we were conducting this research on. So we actually did some regression modeling to kind of predict what attributes were most likely to make one a QAnon believer. And by far, the biggest single predictor is actually consumption of far-right news. And that in the survey means either Newsmax, One America News, Fox News, but Newsmax and One America in particular, and other far right news, makes you nearly 5 times as likely as those who consume mainstream news to be a QAnon believer. Conservative ideology, Republican identity, for example, are also high predictors. And then education level, having a high school degree or less, living in a more rural area versus a more urban or even suburban area. These are all kind of positively associated with and independently associated with being a QAnon believer.
Tom, thanks for that call. We're talking to Robert P. Jones, founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. They are out with a recent survey looking at belief in the QAnon conspiracy theory. Found that it has not been declining, inching up, actually. You can join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences, your encounters with this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Austin in Lafarge. Austin, hi.
Hi there. My name is Austin. Thanks for having my call. Just curious from the gentleman, I've kept a pretty close ear to the QAnon conspiracy over the last year and a half or so. And from my understanding, the so-called Q has not posted anything in quite a long time. And it's been interesting in some of the circles that I watch on YouTube, seeing the sort of ideas pop up around why the Q hasn't posted, what that means, if the Q was nonsense. Wondering what your take on that is and how that plays into the life of the Q conspiracy.
Austin, thanks for the call. And Robert, Austin mentions a key part of the conspiracy theory. Allegedly, Q was someone who claimed to be someone with insider access at the highest levels of government, revealing these secrets, often very cryptically online. And Q, at least the person or persons claiming to be Q, been quiet for a while.
Yeah, I think that's crucial. Like in building the movement, that is the seductive power, I think, of many conspiracy movements, is they claim to have a kind of insider knowledge that other people aren't privy to, like the real truth. Like we know the truth, other people don't. Other people have been, you know, fed this other lie. But there's an insider sense of being in the know, I think, is part of the power of that. And so it is, I think, quite remarkable. The caller is right that since the election, there's been less action, at least initiated by, you know, this mysterious anonymous Q person. And yet the movement itself is still quite animated. And, you know, we have to look no further than just last week, for example, that it's pretty clear to me as someone kind of studying this, that all of the emphasis and overemphasis we had on child pornography last week during Judge Jackson's hearings, for example, by some key folks in the GOP, were really about sending some signals to QAnon followers. This is a core tenet of QAnon. I think for many, many people watching were kind of really surprised or mystified at why all of this emphasis hammering on child pornography. And it's really because it was a signaling to this group of QAnon followers. Again, it's one in four Republicans who aren't just sympathetic, but are really believe all three of these basic tenets, including, and again, that first one, that the government, media, financial worlds are controlled by a group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking operation. And so we hear echoes of that even as recently as last week at the highest levels of government.
We're talking with Robert Jones, CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute, looking at the reach and the popularity of the QAnon conspiracy theory. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the fairly wide influence of QAnon, the conspiracy theory, the ideas it is spreading? Do you worry that it could lead to violence or cause interference with the U.S. political system? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Robert P. Jones, CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. Robert's talking to us about survey data that shows an increase in the number of followers of the QAnon conspiracy theory. You can join in with your questions, maybe your encounters with these ideas in person on social media. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Before we go back to our callers, Robert, I want to talk about why people might find this appealing, QAnon appealing, even after, you know, very specific predictions with dates and times of things happening, mass arrests, the return of the late Robert F. Kennedy Jr. from the grave. I'm not making these up. These are things that have been predicted with days, sometimes times. They haven't happened. What is it about this that makes people still embrace something like this?
Yeah, there I think we need to just take a big step back and ask, yeah, why now? Like, why are we seeing, you know, this movement now? And, you know, I think it's linked to the fact that we are really in the midst of a fairly recent and fairly dramatic shift in the demographics of the population. And that this has set off a really big sense of displacement. You see that in attitudes among QAnon supporters, for example. 7 in 10 QAnon believers believe that the American way of life needs to be protected from foreign influence, or that America is in danger of losing its culture and identity. All these things are really about demographic and religious change in the country. And I think the biggest one to understand, and its connection to kind of white Christian nationalism as well, is this sense that the America was meant to be a white Christian nation, and that we have in the last, you know, 15 years or so gone from being a country that was majority white and Christian. As recently as 2008, when Barack Obama was first running for president, the country was 54% white and Christian. That number today is 44%. So just from 2008 till today, we've kind of gone through this real sea change of being, you know, a country that's no longer majority white and Christian. And I think for a group that saw that as the core identity of of the religion, and indeed even heard in Make America Great Again, that nostalgic looking back and restoring or reclaiming something that's been lost. That's really been the power of this. So I think it's just that we're at this real inflection point in American history in terms of our demographics and religious makeup that is making this, for folks who find that very alarming, a really seductive place to go.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Jeffrey in Mequon. Jeffrey, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. To the pollster, I heard you twice comment that the majority of the political demographic was Republican, 1 in 4, I think you said. Interesting. I didn't hear you mention anything about a Democratic demographic in this poll or independent or any other political bias. And I'm wondering, does that go to your bias or what? Why don't you mention that?
Jeffrey, thanks for the call. Lower rates of Democrats and independents in your survey, Robert, support QAnon. What do you see there?
Yeah, no, happy to do that. And I should say that this, all of this data is open and transparent on PRI's website at PRRI.org, including the full questionnaire, the methodology of the poll, all of that. So I mentioned Republicans because they are overrepresented. The way to think of it, it's 1 in 4 Republicans identify as QAnon are identified as QAnon believers. That the comparison numbers among independents is 14%. And the number among Democrats is 9%. So Republicans are nearly three times as likely to be QAnon believers as Democrats. And when you look across the range of things, it is conservative ideology, it's Republican identity that are far more predictive of believing QAnon than Democratic or liberal identity.
Jeffrey, thanks for calling in with that question at 800-642-1234. Robert, you surveyed this in terms of these core beliefs of QAnon. Do we know if, people you identify as QAnon supporters because they support those beliefs necessarily would brand themselves or name themselves as specifically following QAnon?
That's a good question. You know, in this survey, we thought about this a lot and really decided that, you know, you can kind of go one of two ways in the survey because the way surveys work. If you choose the self-identifying way, you can't then follow up questions because the two contaminate one another. And we decided that the way to get at this with more integrity was to ask the substantive belief questions and not just identifying with the label here. So we don't actually have the self-identify with the label, but we went with the core beliefs. And that way we would also know exactly what we were measuring. Whereas if you just ask people to identify with a label, people might mean very, very different mm-hmm. things, right, with the label. So that's the reason why we went with this methodology.
Talking about the QAnon conspiracy theory still prevalent in the United States, Robert P. Jones is with us from the Public Religion Research Institute. Find information about the recent survey on the topic at PRRI.org. Robert, the material in this conspiracy theory is a very much, I guess, good versus evil sort of scenario, not, you know, our party believes this, your party believes that.
Yeah.
How important is that?
You know, I think that's at the core of it, really. And again, it's not dissimilar from other conspiracy theories. You know, the powerful cocktail, I think, that gives it its power is kind of a few things. One of them is that there is this battle between good and evil. It's a very binary setup. And then it makes it easy to map one's political opponents onto, you know, good or evil, right? And it's one or the other. The other one is a kind of apocalyptic time that we live in extraordinary times where there's going to be a revolution, like that second attribute that, there's a storm coming that's going to sweep away the current leaders and restore the rightful leaders, that there's even a supernatural power coming. So it's mapped, again, not just to good and evil in a kind of human way, but good and evil in a kind of cosmic or divine way, so that one sees oneself inside that world as acting not just on behalf of good or evil in general, but on behalf of the divine or God.
Let's go back to our callers now. Barbara is with us in Boscobel. Barbara, hello.
Yes, hi. I find it extremely frightening that so many people believe these conspiracy theories and QAnon theories. I wonder if Robert has gained any insight as to why they believe this way and what can be done to bring them back into reality and believe truth instead of lies.
Interesting question, Robert.
Yeah, well, first thing to say is I would reinforce, you know, I've been doing kind of social science and public opinion polling for, you know, decades. And I would say, you know, I'm alarmed, you know, just from the standpoint of a healthy democracy, because, you know, these are not just far-flung beliefs in the abstract, but they're far-flung beliefs that have direct implications for a healthy democracy. And including one of the three, again, one of the three tenets is that people might have to resort to political violence. So if you add a kind of battle of good and evil and this sense that you may have to take up arms to maim or even kill your fellow citizens, I mean, this is a very dangerous thing for a democracy. So, you know, I'm hopeful that you know, I think there's no silver bullet here for, you know, kind of finding a quick solution here. But I do think part of it is, you know, having a different kind of story, right? And that's really what democracy's been, is offering a different kind of a way of dealing with political power. And it is the basic idea that, you know, yes, we have these political fights and debates and we have elections, and then, you know, we live with the consequences of those elections. And I'm hopeful that we can, you know, this is a fever that may break and that we'll get back there. But I do think the troubling thing here is that this is a set of things that is like, no, we can't let an election stand. And for example, QAnon believers, 7 in 10 QAnon believers say that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. Right. So they see it as illegitimate. And that sense of shared legitimacy, I think, is what we really are in danger of losing here. So I think anything we can all do to kind of shore up, you know, the legitimacy of our democratic institutions is, you know, the only way to hang on and to resist these things that are chipping away at these basic pillars of democracy.
Barbara, thanks for that call. Robert, in a past program, a caller brought up this idea. I've seen it suggested elsewhere, continuity between key themes in the QAnon conspiracy theory and things like anti-Semitic conspiracy theories over the centuries. How much of this do you see mapping onto past destructive theories?
I think that's right. That, you know, again, where we have the evidence for that is in some of these other attitudes that kind of are very, very high among QAnon believers. So, for example, 7 in 10 QAnon believers believe that the values of Islam are at odds with American values and way of life. The gods, you know, granted America a special role in human history as a Christian country. And this, you know, sense of external, you know, threats. So I think all of those things are very, very strong, I think, within this QAnon phenomenon.
In just our last minute, Robert, what are you watching for now in this 2022 election season when it comes to the influence of this conspiracy theory?
Well, you know, paying attention to how much play I think what it really does matter. The other way of kind of moving away from this is it matters that 1 in 4 in one of our two major political parties have become susceptible to believing all three of these statements. And I think political leadership matters. So I think Democratic leaders for sure, Democratic Party leaders for sure, but I think the onus is even more on Republican Party leaders to really clearly denounce this and call their followers kind of back to, absolutely a fight of ideas, a fight of principles, but to call them back from this precipice of, indulging and believing in these conspiracy theories that are really linked to political violence.
Robert, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Robert P. Jones is the CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. He's authored the book White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. He joined us to share survey information about the lasting influence and prevalence of the QAnon conspiracy theory. Coming up after the news, we learn more about the Ukrainian refugee crisis and what role the United States is playing in the aid effort. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.